AP Radio News. I'm Tim McGuire. The Islamic militant group that has grabbed much of northern Iraq has posted images of fighters gunning down dozens of captured Iraqi soldiers. An Iraqi general says he's heard reports of mass murder of captive soldiers. A UN spokeswoman says there is word that the group, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL, rounded up soldiers and civilians in Mosul, then shot them in the streets. AP correspondent David Melendi reports President Obama has ordered some U.S. ships closer to Iraq.
Pentagon spokesman Rear Admiral John Kirby says the aircraft carrier USS George H.W. Bush, guided missile cruiser USS Philippine Sea, and guided missile destroyer USS Truxton are being moved into the Persian Gulf in case they're needed to protect Americans and U.S. interests in Iraq. Kirby says Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel ordered the move to give President Obama flexibility if military options are needed.
In northern Iraq, the militants are attacking yet another city using weapons and rockets seized when troops fled the fight earlier last week. President Obama tells graduating seniors in California people who argue against climate change are ignoring the science. Ed Donahue has more.
Speaking to graduates at the University of California, Irvine, the president said he needs their help to take action on global warming.
Today's Congress, though, is full of folks who stubbornly and automatically reject the scientific evidence about climate change. They will tell you it is a hoax or a fad.
He says Americans should be determined to do big things.
Progress on climate change is a big thing.
Obama told the graduates they have to fight the stubborn status quo.
You've got to remind everyone who represents you at every level of government that doing something about climate change is a prerequisite for your vote.
The president said it's pretty rare you'll run into somebody who says a problem you're trying to solve simply doesn't exist. I'm Ed Donahue.
People living in about 500 homes have been told they need to evacuate ahead of a smoky wildfire in Southern California. This is AP Radio News. Martin Keimer had a bit of trouble in the third round of the U.S. Open, but still holds a big lead heading into today's final round. Jim Militello tells us more.
Keimer will take a five-shot lead into the final round. After posting only one bogey in his first 36 holes, he put five on his card in a 2-over 72. The good news for Keimer is that Pinehurst number 2 finally played as tough as its reputation, with only two golfers shooting under par in the third round. One is Eric Compton, a two-time heart transplant recipient. He shot a 3-under 67. So did Ricky Fowler, who's tied with Compton in second place. Henrik Stenson and Dustin Johnson are six back. Brant Snedeker seven behind. Only those six are under par for the three rounds. Jim Militello, Pinehurst, North Carolina.
San Antonio Spurs hold a 3-1 edge over defending NBA champs Miami as they ready for Game 5 tonight in San Antonio. The Heat face a tough task. In the NBA, no team has successfully rallied from 3-1 down in the finals. I'm Tim McGuire, AP Radio News.
GovEvents.com is your one-stop shop for government and military events worldwide. With hundreds of event organizers posting their government and military-related conferences, trade shows, expos, webcasts, and more, you'll save time and energy using GovEvents to find events to attend, exhibit, or sponsor. Search for government and military events by date, location, keyword, organizer, or focus. It's free, so join today. GovEvents.com. That's GovEvents.com.
Today in school, I learned a lot. In chemistry, I learned that no one likes me. In biology, I learned that I'm fat and stupid. In English, I learned that I'm disgusting. And in gym, I learned that I'm pathetic and a joke. The only thing I didn't learn in school today is why no one ever helps.
Kids witness bullying every day. They want to help, but they don't know how. Teach them how to stop bullying and be more than a bystander at stopbullying.gov. A message from the Ad Council.
This is Mark Amtower. If you're looking for cost-effective and efficient methods for marketing your products or services to the government or to other government contractors, look to LinkedIn. There are over 400,000 members in the D.C. area and more than 92 million nationwide, but only a small percentage actually use it well. I can show you how to leverage LinkedIn in ways that support your marketing, sales, and business development efforts. I do this for large and small companies, and I can do it for you. Drop me a line at mark@federaldirect.net.
Runners, do you need a race slot for the Army 10-miler? Join Team Fisher House to become a champion for military families and get a guaranteed slot at this year's race. Fisher House secured a limited number of race slots exclusively for their supporters. Do more to show your support of the military than by saying thanks for your service. Take action. Join the team to make a real difference in the lives of service members, veterans, and their families when they need it during a medical crisis. Register today at teamfisherhouse.org/ATM.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the offices of the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Les Smolin, with my co-host, Mark Cohn of Optifor. We have a great lineup of guests for you today on our show, including Marjorie Levin Scher, Executive Director of the Medical Care for Children Partnership Foundation, Gretchen McCracken, co-founder and partner, Golden Key Group, Manesh Gupta, President and CEO of Nixoft Systems Corp., and Stephen Selleck, Managing Director, Norris Advisors, LLC. First up is Marjorie Levin Scher, Executive Director of the Medical Care for Children Partnership Foundation. Welcome, Marjorie. Marjorie, what is the Medical Care for Children Partnership Foundation?
MCCP Foundation provides medical and dental care for children without health insurance in low-income families. We're the last safety net for these kids. If they don't have private insurance and they don't qualify for public programs, we take care of them through our network of private doctors and dentists.
And how big or small? How many doctors or dentists?
We have 300 doctors and dentists in our network, as well as Kaiser Permanente, and we take care of about 2,700 children a year.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty sizable, and you must have a large organization behind you doing that, other than these paid volunteers and these doctors and dentists.
No, we don't have a lean and mean organization. We have a skinny and emaciated organization. There's only two paid staff, me and my director of operations, and a wonderful group of volunteers, as well as our physician dental network.
And when did this organization get started?
It's a relatively new organization, founded in 2009, so we just had our fifth anniversary. But originally, it was started as a project of the Fairfax County government and spun off in 2008, 2009 as a nonprofit.
So they spun it off in 2009 as a nonprofit, you said, and they hired you as a result?
A group of business people in Fairfax County were very interested in this organization and wanted to not have it die, but to start up a new life. And so they hired me to start it up and get it going as a 501c3 nonprofit.
So what did they see in you at that time that said you're the right person for this job?
Well, I am an entrepreneur. I have started a number of businesses, including a consulting firm, which I built up and after 15 years sold, and then I was working for the company that bought mine. In 2009, at the beginning, I decided to leave that and try to work in the nonprofit sector for a while.
Why was that important for you?
I had always sat on boards of directors of nonprofits and volunteered and really thought it was time in my life to concentrate on the nonprofit sector for a while and lead an organization in that way.
Mm-hmm. So what was it about you that said, I could do this, as opposed to, well, this is can be a risky, especially when you get a spinoff coming out of a government entity?
I've started a number of organizations, as I said, my own consulting firm, and through my client work, I started a number of nonprofit organizations. I knew how to do that. I knew I could do it.
Mm-hmm. You knew you could do it. So where does this entrepreneurial seed, as we spoke about it earlier, come from?
Through osmosis, I learned it through my father. I was never taught to be an entrepreneur, but he owned his own accounting firm. He was a CPA, and he always talked about how it was a very positive thing to be your own boss and do things your own way.
Did you ever work for him?
I never worked for him, no.
Hmm. So you just kind of took this away from him.
I took it away from him because I was brought up in a stereotypical suburban household, kind of Ozzie and Harriet type thing, and I was not taught to be a leader or a founder of an organization. I was just taught to kind of do well, whatever that meant. But after a while, I decided that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be an entrepreneur.
So what were your choices that were presented to you when you were growing up?
I was growing up in an era when girls could be a nurse, a secretary, or a teacher. I chose teacher. So I graduated from college and became a teacher.
So what changed you?
This was the era of when feminism was becoming in the wind quite strongly, and I got caught up in it and realized that I had more potential and could do more things with my life than I had previously thought.
What actually happened, if you can remember? Was there an event or something that occurred that said, wait, I can do different than what I'm doing now?
Well, I read a number of books, including Betty Friedan's book, and I was in graduate school at the time, and we had...
Preparing for a career in education.
Well, I was getting a graduate degree in education, we had these circles, feminist circles, I forget what they called them, but anyway, we would talk amongst ourselves about our potential and what we could do. I actually... co-wrote a book at that time called Dick and Jane as Victims. If you remember the Dick and Jane readers,
sure.
When you were little, maybe.
Yes, I do. And
C-Spot
Run.
It was the gender stereotypical typecasting that we wrote about.
So you grow up in the kind of environment that you describe, and here it is. There's this thread of a conversation that the nation is having, and it grabs you.
Yes, exactly.
What do you think it was about you that said, I was ready to be receiving this message and to alter the path? I mean, you did start off in the education realm. You picked one of the three.
Yes, I did.
But then you shifted gears.
Well, I taught for a few years, and I realized, okay, that I could do that, that I was good at it, but now what?
Yeah.
And I became very interested in my work in graduate school, and that was at the same time that this feminist stream was going around me and just changed my thinking.
So we got the be your own boss piece and controlling, taking control of your life in that regard. What about mom? What was she doing? And
mom was a homemaker,
uh-huh.
But very well educated and very wise woman, and very giving and kind. And from her, I learned the importance of knowledge and the importance of giving back to the community.
Was she highly educated?
She was a college graduate. She also was a teacher in her own time.
Oh, really?
But not after she had children.
Mm-hmm. So you said there were a couple of things that you took away from her, the thing about the importance of learning.
Mm-hmm.
Kindness is something else that you threw in there. Mm-hmm. Where does that fit in the mix here? Because I can't imagine CEOs or even executive directors being kind.
My parents both gave back to the community a lot.
Mm-hmm.
They were active in organizations that helped less fortunate people in the community in different ways. And so that was part of my upbringing, too, to always give back.
And you've been groomed that way.
I've been groomed to give back to the community and do it in my own way as an entrepreneur.
Uh-huh. So what would you say is the imprint that you have in terms of your own way? What is that, if you can synopsize it?
I like to develop and lead organizations that have a mission that I am passionate about,
mm-hmm.
And that's what I've done throughout my career.
Is that important?
Very important to me. To feel that my life has been led helping other people, making other people's lives a little bit better in some way.
So you're doing that now. Actually, it sounds like you've been doing it for a long time.
I think I've been doing it throughout my career. At least I've been trying.
Mm-hmm. Is what you're doing and the success you've had surprise mom or dad?
I think it did. They passed away quite a while ago, but I think it did surprise them because, as I said, not that they didn't believe I had talent and intelligence, but I wasn't really brought up to do this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think my father was very, very proud, and my mom also, but always worried that I worked too hard.
Worked too hard?
Yeah.
You mean you don't have to?
Well, my mother worried that her little girl was working too hard.
Uh-huh. Now, you mentioned you had an older brother, too.
Yes.
Is he surprised by the success you've had?
Probably. But he also was formed by stereotypes, too. He was a lawyer. He was supposed to, you know, be very successful as a male,
mm-hmm.
and he was a lawyer. I don't think he enjoyed it very much. He's been retired for some time now.
Oh, really? So what would he have said you were like growing up as a child?
Bratty little girl.
Bratty little girl. You can take that one, Mark.
Right. Okay. And so where does that come from? Tell us about that.
I think it's just, you know, I don't think it had a whole lot of meaning to it. Just the two siblings living in a nice home. You know, we were 4.5 years apart, so we weren't really, you know, we didn't play together that much. And he was a boy, I was a girl. 4.5 years is a long span.
Mm-hmm. So at the time growing up, and how, well, it sounds like in a lot, the environment you grew up in, I'm not talking just the community as well, but what was happening in the country, had a huge impact on you. Mm-hmm. Would you think that it would have laid the path out for you that you're on now, or how did you get on the path knowing that this was just the event or situation or circumstance that kind of reshaped the way you looked at everything?
Well, I was in college in the 60s, mm-hmm. You know, that was a turbulent time. I remember picketing and coming down to Washington to yell at the White House, and you know, I was very impacted by the 60s to be an activist.
Mm. And so you are. Actually, in an organization that's very activist-oriented in that regard.
Yeah.
Taking care of those who can't take necessarily care of themselves.
Yes, and all the organizations that I have led have had that kind of stream to them where we are activists and trying to make the world a better place.
Huh. That's a great place to probably stop. So what's the website address there, Marjorie?
MCCPFoundation, spelled out, .org.
Thank you. I'd like to thank my co-host, Mark Cohn of Opti4. We've been speaking with Marjorie Levine, thank you, Cher, Executive Director of the Medical Care for Children Partnership Foundation. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight.
This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining me for this segment is Doug Kay, who is a principal with a firm called Offit Kerman. What is Offit Kerman, Doug?
Offit Kerman is a full-service law firm in the Mid-Atlantic region with offices from Philadelphia all the way down to Tysons Corner, Virginia, where I work.
Right. And you're a lawyer with the firm?
I'm a lawyer with the firm.
What practice area do you specialize in?
I mostly do work in commercial litigation, although I also do work in doing criminal defense and personal injury, anything that gets me to trial.
Anything that gets you to trial. Well, why do your customers appreciate you?
I think they appreciate me because I am a careful and sympathetic listener, and I try to offer concrete solutions to their most vexing legal problems.
Well, give us an example. Do you have, without mentioning specifics, a recent example of where you were really good at this? How about your favorite client up till now, without getting into two particulars there?
Well, I represented a fellow who was in a commercial lease, and the landlord was determined to make him pay more than he should have been paying. And we had to go to court, and we had to go all the way through trial, and the client really appreciated the effort, and we got an excellent result for the client. And that was very satisfying, and since then he's been talking me up all over town, so I can't thank him enough.
Yeah. What's the best part of practicing law for you?
I would say that it is taking people through difficult circumstances when they think they don't have any options and trying to find a good solution for them.
Right. What's the website address for the law firm?
www.offitkerman.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Doug Kay, who's the principal with Offit Kerman. This is Peter Schwartz, and that was your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Les Smolin, with my co-host, Mark Cohn. For this segment, we have Gretchen McCracken, co-founder and partner, Golden Key Group. Welcome, Gretchen. Gretchen, what is the Golden Key Group?
The Golden Key Group is a service-disabled veteran small business headquartered in Reston, Virginia, and we focus primarily on federal human resources and human capital management. We represent 23 agencies in the federal government.
And how big or small is the company?
We're about 150 employees mm-hmm. currently. And we started in 2002.
You started in 2002. What was going on in 2002?
We were making transitions, and I decided that we were going to be moving, and it was time to start something different, and I ended up starting the company with my sister.
So you started the company with sister. When you said we were moving, who were we referring to? Your family?
My husband.
Your husband, yes. And you.
Yeah.
And you decided whatever it is that we're doing, we're going to change.
We didn't know what we were going to do. We knew it would evolve. And so we set off on a path, and it evolved over the next couple of years, and we focused in on federal human resources.
So take us back. There was an interesting story you told us in the green room. So how did this company actually get started? What was going on at that time?
So the company actually got started. A friend of mine was trying very hard to entice me into coming into the federal government contracting world, and I was resistant to it because I'd never been in it before. I did not understand it. I didn't know it at the time.
So you knew nothing about that world?
No, nothing. And so she convinced me to go to a meeting, and at the meeting they happened to call on me to ask me to come down and talk about our organization that we didn't really have yet. Uh-huh. And so at that moment...
Oh, wait. You didn't even have one?
No.
So you're invited down to this meeting.
She knew that we had been talking about this. She knew that it was during a time when the service disabled veteran set aside was going to become a law, and it was no longer going to be just a goal. Mm-hmm. And she knew that on this one particular contract, it was going to be a requirement. And she knew that there were not many that were service-disabled veteran yet. The companies had not started. And so she knew we had the ability to be that. And so she took me along to the meeting, and this gentleman asked if there were any service-disabled veteran companies in the audience. And she said, yes, right here next to me, and she pointed to me.
Oh, she just kept pushing you.
And she just kept pushing. And so he asked me to come down and talk about our company. And I went down, and I talked about some of the things that I thought we would be good at. Uh-huh. And he said, tell me about your set-asides. And I did. And I said, we're a small business. We are service-disabled veteran. Mm-hmm. And one of the partners lives in a hub zone area, and we're trying to decide if we should be a hub zone. And he said, wow, you've got all the keys. What's the name of your company? And I said, Golden Key Group.
And you made it up right there on the spot.
Yes, I did. And that's how we got started, and we never looked back.
So your friend had to see something in you that said she needs to be here without knowing what could come of it. What did she see in you? I'm assuming it's a she.
It is. I think she saw the persistence that just comes out of me naturally. I'm one of those people that doesn't quit easily. You know, I'm the person where if you put me in the barn, I'd be the one looking for the pony in the pile of everything.
When did you realize that, one, you were persistent, and two, don't quit easily? So take us back in your younger days. What was going on for you back then that this showed up?
So I was the youngest of four children.
Uh-huh.
And
what was mom and dad doing?
My father was a school teacher. My mother ran an office at the local hospital. She ran all the outpatient operations. So I was the youngest of the four kids, and my father being a school teacher, having served in World War II, in fact, 70 years ago today, he landed on the beach and fought his way to Berlin. So we take those lessons with us. And and so he taught us very early on that a failure was never a failure unless we failed to learn the lessons. And so he encouraged us to learn lessons so that we didn't repeat failures. But it was okay to fail. And you picked up and you realized and you analyzed what you did wrong and you thought about it. And when you went to do it again, you didn't make the same mistake.
Did he ever fail at anything?
Oh, I'm sure he did. In my eyes,
yeah.
He never did.
He was perfect, I'm sure.
Oh, he was. He was perfect. He was a very mild-mannered person.
Uh-huh.
And was a wonderful school teacher. And
was he a school teacher for you at all?
No.
So you went to school in the same school district, but...
I did.
He wasn't your teacher or administrator?
No, he was not. That was the one thing that my parents insisted on when we were in the school district, was that we were not allowed to be in the same school where he was teaching, because they didn't want any perception that we were being favored by any teacher, mm-hmm. because they were affiliated with him in teaching.
So where did this idea of this, you know, failure's not failure and less come from for him?
I think just through his life in general. He grew up and during the Depression. He went off to World War II and fought his way and came home and made a living like so many other people did in that generation. And it was hard, and they worked hard, and he insisted on giving back. Mm-hmm. And he taught us those same lessons.
But you never gave up. No. I mean, that, the persistence. Persistence seems
was,
to come out
yeah,
of that.
That's what he wanted out of us. He never wanted us to settle for mediocrity.
So what was it like around the dinner table when you were a kid?
So dinner table. First of all, we were a family that always sat down for dinner together, and we continued that on. I had five children, and we did the same thing.
You did the same thing with your kids?
Mm-hmm. It was very important to have dinner with... First of all, I cook. I love to cook.
Uh-huh.
And my kids and my husband love to eat. So we always had dinner, and we always sat around, and that's when you learn things, and that's when you understand who their friends are, what they're doing, what's interesting to them and what's not. And I know, looking back now, I know my parents were doing the same thing to us. Now, in my dad's case, sometimes he might have known ahead of time when maybe we weren't so good in school that day, mm-hmm. and he let us know in an indirect way that
so
he
knew
about
it. So what
did he
do at the dinner table?
So you got the proverbial from one of them, so how was school today? What did you do today? Did you have any tests today? And you would do your best to avoid any kind of answers, and uh-huh. you'd say, fine, nothing, whatever a typical junior high or high school student would answer to their parents. And then he would give you one of those cues where he would say, so for example, so what happened in science class today?
He already knew.
And he already knew that you had been bouncing the frog eyes around the classroom and they landed in some girl's hair and you got sent to the principal's office. So you at that point just silently we sat there and thought to yourself, he knows, and please, please don't tell mom.
So it's kind of like you can't get away with everything because no. you know, eyes and ears are on you. Everybody knows who you are.
Absolutely.
How does that affect you growing up?
I think it teaches you a couple of things about reputation and respect. He had an impeccable reputation. In fact, to the extent that when he died, they made a scholarship in his honor that is still going on today in that school district.
Wow.
So he changed a lot of lives. You know, we have one of his students gave my mother a plaque that he had had 9 kids from the same family that he had taught. And when he got the last one through, they brought him a plaque and it says, "A teacher affects eternity. You can never tell where their influence stops." And that still hangs in my mother's house today. It still hangs in the living room.
And this had a profound effect on you.
It did.
So how does it show up for you today?
Because you realize the influences that you can have on other people, and you realize what that reputation and that integrity means.
So as a leader...
And you don't sacrifice it.
Okay, so as a leader in your organization,
mm-hmm.
How important is protecting your reputation?
For the organization, for myself personally, for my partners, my sister is a partner, my husband is a partner, my husband's the managing partner.
So you've continued the family affair.
Yeah, sometimes it's a family affair, and sometimes it's an interesting dialogue that goes on. I'll just put it that way. So what ends up happening is you protect that reputation because at the end of the day, we got to go home together. Or we got to see each other on Friday for dinner. Or we have, you know, we come to work in the morning, and at the end of the day, we got to go home, and we have to agree on what we've done as an organization and what we've done as the leadership group.
That's a great story. What's the website address?
www.goldenkeygroup.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Gretchen McCracken, co-founder and partner of Golden Key Group. I'd like to thank my co-host, Mark Cohn of Opti4, for helping with the interview. And don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight. This is Les Smolin with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is Mark Cohn, founder of Cohn and Burnett, a law firm. Mark, welcome. What is Cohn and Burnett?
We are a law firm that focuses on trusts and estates. So we do wills, trusts, powers of attorney, estate planning, and estate administration.
And what's your role in the company?
I'm the founder and the senior partner.
So what does it mean to be a senior partner?
Well, it means that in our case, I'm the thought leader, the visionary, the one who tries to figure out where we're headed. I'm not the managing partner who runs the day-to-day operations.
Okay, and what makes Cohn and Burnett so special?
We are, first of all, focused on taking care of our clients and just on their estate planning and administration. And I think we're one of the first firms in the area to introduce a fixed fee for doing estate planning.
Interesting. And what do they really appreciate about you and the company, your clients, that is?
You know, the clients tell me that they just love the experience. They are very comfortable and confident that their needs are being met here, and they enjoy working with us.
Hmm. And who or what is your perfect client, if you will?
Our perfect client is anybody who cares about what's going to happen to them when they can no longer take care of themselves or their family.
Mm-hmm. And what is it you actually enjoy most about the work?
You know, talking to the clients, that's the part. I could turn over all of the work to other attorneys here, but I hold on to the first part, which is meeting the clients, talking to them, getting to know them, getting to understand where they're, what they need and what they're looking for.
That's great. What's the website for Cohen and Burnett?
CohenandBurnett.com, all spelled out, the A and D in between there.
Thank you, Mark. We've been speaking with Mark Cohen, founder of Cohen and Burnett. This is Les Smolin, and that's been your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Les Smolin, with my co-host, Mark Cohen of Opti4. For this segment, we've got Manesh Gupta, president and CEO of Nixoft Systems Corp. Welcome, Manesh. Manesh, what is Nixoft Systems Corp?
So Nixoft Systems Corp is a IT company. We're a small disadvantaged business that primarily provides support to federal government customers, including defense and civilian agencies.
Mm-hmm. And how big or small is it?
So we're about 100 people.
About 100 people. And when did you first get a job with them?
When did I get first a job with them? That's a good question. I started working for Nixoft in 1998.
Uh-huh. And was this a company you started?
Yes, I started this company, and I'm still employed there. So.
and what made you decide to start your own company?
So basically, you know, I came to this country as a student in 1990, and I always wanted to try to be an entrepreneur. So in 98, I got an opportunity to try to do that. So I said, okay, let's give it a shot and see how it goes. And here we are 15 years later.
What do you mean, let's give it a shot and see how it goes? That kind of doesn't sound as I would probably think, I'm going to start a company and we're going to build this into the biggest, baddest
Well,
company.
Yeah, everybody wants to do that. But, you know, it's easier said than done, because you start a company when you have a family, you have responsibilities. So you have to always be prepared for not succeeding. Doesn't mean you give up, but you got to have the backup. You got to have an alternative with what happens if I don't succeed. So you got to have a safety net when you have a family. So, mm-hmm. so that's what it means.
What was it about you that basically gave you either the confidence or instilled in you this idea that I can do this, and even if it doesn't work, I can still do this or something?
So the idea was, you know, I mean, we're talking about 1998, so IT was starting to boom, and, you know, we have an education background, had worked in the industry for 8 years. So we figured, if I can do this for other people, why not do it for myself? Mm-hmm. What's the worst that would happen? Okay, we will fail. Well, you can always go back and get a job again. So it's yeah, there's a risk, but it's not that big a risk.
So you didn't see this as a risk that had all kinds of dire consequences built around it?
No, not really. I mean, you know, when you've been in the IT space, you have the qualifications, your fallback is always a job. So that was your worst case scenario. So okay, maybe you lost 3 months, 6 months, 1 year, but you could always recover from that.
So how old were you when the idea of, I want to start my own business, started to appear?
That was right out of grad school. I was about 24 years old when I graduated, so right about that. But I needed to get some experience under the belt, know how the space works, know what to do and what not to do. So it took about 7-8 years to get there.
You know, in the green room, you talked about being back in India and learning from your grandfather. What lesson did you get from him?
Well, so my grandfather, you know, he was very hardworking. He was a businessman. He had his own business. And
this is back in India.
Back in India. And even though he had his own business, he was still spending 14, 15-hour days. And the reason he was doing that was because he wanted a better future for his children, his three kids are here now. So that was the motivation. So I saw him as I was a child doing that.
Did you work for him?
No.
So, but you saw him doing this. What did he do? Did he share these stories with you? Did you spend a lot of time with him?
No, because, you know, we used to spend summers with the grandfather 3 months every summer. So we would see, even though all the grandkids were there, he was still busy all the time and doing what he did.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the work ethics is what was important.
Is that what you basically pulled away for you?
Yes.
So as Mark was asking, the entrepreneurial seed for that, I mean, where does that come from then?
Well, that comes from really it's just trying to make a better life for you and the next generation, I guess, for the children. And yeah, you can work, and then the entrepreneurial piece is that I guess the feeling for working for yourself and having the flexibility of doing what you need to do and want to do. That was the motivation for that. So, mm-hmm.
So you had told us something earlier that growing up in India, you only had two options. I'm keen off the idea of flexibility when you're actually given two paths and two paths only.
Right. So, you know, when we were growing up, right from even in middle school, I mean, my parents would say, okay, you only really have two choices. You either become a doctor or an engineer. And that time, that was a very, very common practice because, as you know, my dad said, education is something that nobody can take away from you, no matter what happens in life.
Mm-hmm.
That will always be there. So,
do you believe that?
Absolutely.
Are you a testament to that?
I would say so, yes.
Mm. Now, you also mentioned you had some other brothers and sisters.
Yes, so I have a younger brother and a younger sister. And
Were the same choices available, same paths to your brother and sister?
Unfortunately for my brother, since I decided not to become one doctor, he got stuck with being a doctor. So.
I'm sure he resents you now, right?
He's doing fairly well for himself. Uh-huh. So
is he here also?
No, he's still back in India. He stays with my parents back in India.
So you came here by yourself?
Yes.
What was that like?
It was okay. I mean, it was just like going to a college, just in a different country.
So was that commonplace where you grew up?
It's very commonplace, yes.
So coming to the United States, did you know anybody?
Yes, I did actually, because my three uncles, my mom's three younger brothers, were already here. So I had a lot of support from the family. So uh-huh. It wasn't that difficult a transition for us.
So it made it easier for you?
Very easy, yes.
And you already had school lined up?
Yes, and I had school lined up. Admissions was there, so mm-hmm. That was not a problem.
What was Dad doing?
Dad was working for the oil company in India for his entire life.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he was working very hard. I mean, there were times when he would get up at 4 to go and then wouldn't be back for a week.
You wouldn't see him for a whole week?
For a whole week. So Mom was the one that was taking care of us.
So what happens when you're the oldest of the three children when Dad goes away for a week? What happens What happens to you as a child in terms of, do you have to pick up additional responsibilities? You become the man of the house. How does that work?
Not really. I mean, we were still children at that time, so Mom was really taking care of everything. You know, she would get us ready for school, make sure that when we came back from school, you know, lunch was there, everything was there. She would make sure that all of our homework was completed. You know, so she basically took over the responsibility for everything.
You told us an interesting story about that in terms of her sitting with you and waking up early.
Right. So basically, one of the things we did when we were growing up through middle school and high school was we would not stay up late, but we would actually get up at 4 in the morning to study. And Mom would get up every day with us, and she would just sit on the dining table with us, just there so that we had company while we were studying. And she did this for continuously for 8 years.
And why was it important for her to do that?
It was important for her to do that because she knew that, you know, while she didn't go to school, but, you know, she wanted her kids to succeed in education, and she wanted to provide support. And that was the only way she could provide support, because she couldn't help us study. But that's what she could do, be there for us
mm-hmm.
and motivate us.
So is that what made you different from all your other peers in your school in India? Because they didn't all come to this country and become professionals, right?
I would say that, you know, the family support was definitely important, and we try to do the same thing for our children where possible.
Meaning what? You actually, somebody gets up in your family, your wife gets up?
Not me, but my wife, it's the reverse, because my children, they study late, so my wife would stay up with them, And up until 2 years ago, when children started saying, okay, mom, we're okay, you can go to sleep now. So she had stopped doing that now because he's a junior now, so, you know.
Mm-hmm. So when you think about what your mom did, and I don't hear that as a sacrifice, you said it was her way of supporting you.
Right. It's not a sacrifice because that's what mom's supposed to do. And this was her way of doing what she could to make sure that we all succeeded.
And so when you think back to that, how does it kind of show up for you today? How did that influence or impact you in terms of how you lead today?
So basically, the leading is important because you got to let people do what they are supposed to do and not do it for them, but provide them the tools and the support that they need. For example, one of the things in our company is we don't penalize people for failing. The only reason you failed is because at least you tried the best you did. Now, if you don't try, that's a problem. Failure is not always a problem. So we promote that culture in the company to make sure that people are not afraid of making decisions and trying to do what they're supposed to do and what they're hired to do.
Mm-hmm. So as a leader, that's the way you want to be known in terms of your employees look to you and realize that that's the gift you give them?
Absolutely, because if you're going to hire people and then you're going to tell them what to do and how to do, then you really don't need them because you're paying them too much to not do anything for you. So you have
to. Well, isn't
it
about making money? Isn't what everybody wants to do?
Well, yes, yeah, about making money also. But when you're hiring people, they are there not just for salary; they are there for fulfillment. And if you're not going to let them do what they're supposed to do, yeah, they will last for some time, but they will not succeed.
And that's important?
That's very important.
Why is that important?
Yeah, because you know, people don't work just for money. Yes, they need money to survive, but they work because they have to feel like they're here because they are welcome here and not just because they're forced to be here.
That also has something to do with scalability, right?
Absolutely, because if as a CEO, you start getting involved and micromanaging every activity in the company, not only are you going to not scale, but you won't be able to deliver on what you're supposed to do. I mean, as a CEO, it's you get to a point where you don't have to do everything yourself. You don't want to do everything yourself. You have to let people do what they're supposed to do.
That's great. What's the website address, Manish?
It's www.niksoft, which is niksoft.com.
We've been speaking with Manish Gupta, President and CEO of Niksoft Systems Corp. I'd like to thank my co-host, Mark Cohn of Opti4, for helping with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight. This is Les Smolin with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is Jody Ruth, founder and president of Acumetrics. Welcome, Jody. Jody, what is Acumetrics?
Acumetrics is a firm that works with CEOs that are interested in growing their revenues and bottom lines in a scalable, sustainable way.
And what's your role within the company?
I'm the founder and president.
And what is it about the job that you bring that's so unique to you, that special gift, as we say?
That special gift? I enjoy working with the CEOs to have them achieve goals that they thought were impossible.
And what is it about the organization that makes it so special?
We work, our clients say that it's the three P's, our people, our platform, and our processes. Our people are highly qualified and they're fun to work with. Mm-hmm. Our processes are enabling of reliable and timely financial information, and our platform is scalable.
And who is, or what is perhaps, the perfect client for you?
Businesses of any size that want reliable, timely financial information.
Mm-hmm. And what do you enjoy most about this work?
I enjoy working with the clients and making a difference. We like to help the CEOs understand their financial information so they can make different choices tomorrow to impact future results of the business.
That's great. What's the website for the company?
www.acumetricsllc.com.
Thank you, Jody.
Thanks, Les.
We've been speaking with Jody Ruth, founder and president of Acumetrics. This is Les Smolin, and that's been your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Les Smolin, with my co-host, Mark Cohn of Opti4. For this segment, We've got Stephen Selleck, Managing Director of Norris Advisors, LLC. Welcome, Stephen. Stephen, what is Norris Advisors, LLC?
We're a consulting firm. We are expert witnesses in corporate litigation. Most of our people focus on the more quantitative aspects of corporate litigation, whether it be pure economics, regulatory, or other types of non-legal sides of litigation.
Mm-hmm. And how big or small is the company?
We're about 50 people.
And when did you get started with it?
I've actually been doing this kind of work since I graduated from college. So it'll be 25 years this August.
So you've been doing it for 25 years, but this firm, was it yours that you started?
It was. I spun myself out from a previous firm that I had worked at in 2007 and started Norris then.
So what was the motivation for you back then?
The firm was going through some changes, and I sort of took a little time to reflect and realized that I could be happier, I thought, on my own, and was fortunate enough to have clients that were willing to go with me on that, and just decided to give it a try.
So it kind of took some of the risk out of doing that?
It certainly took a lot of the risk out of doing that, knowing that A, I had been doing this work for many years, and B, I had a number of very solid clients that were happy to come with me.
Mm-hmm. So what is it that you think prepared you to basically say, I'm done working for others and I want to go do this for myself now?
Probably having been in firms for, at the time, 15 years or so, and making observations and thinking that I could do things as well or better, and I wanted to at least give it a shot and see if I could do things the way I wanted to.
I hear that from a lot of people, but there's also risk associated with doing that. So when you take those things, I mean, you could have gone and found another firm. You didn't have to go do it on your own. So, you know,
a lot of the firms are very much the same. I wanted to do something different. And, you know, this is a question we actually confront when we recruit people to our firm. They're at firms that they're quite comfortable with. And so I think it's a matter of perspective.
So what's different?
The big difference, I think, is really seeing things differently. If you what you think is safe and secure isn't. Because if you're not producing and doing well at a larger firm or any firm, you're probably not going to be kept around very long. So why not be at a place that's going to let you realize more of the advantages of your work and let you keep that?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking, let's go back to your childhood. And you mentioned seeing things differently. When did you first notice as a kid that you could see things differently?
You know, it's funny. I don't remember a specific point. I think a lot has always been expected of me, and I think it's always... I grew up knowing or feeling that there was probably nothing I couldn't do if I wanted to try. It was just a...
How did you know that?
I think someone else I heard recently referred to it as osmosis, and I think that's probably the best way to think about it. It's not a word I came up with myself, but it describes it well.
From osmosis from where?
From parents, my grandparents, from teachers. There was just somehow always this baseline assumption that if you put your mind to it and if you try, that you'll be able to do it. There was no limit, no constraint to thinking about things that way from what I remember.
Mm-hmm. What was Mom doing?
My mother was a homemaker when I was younger, and as we got a little, my younger sister and I, as we got a little older, she was a receptionist at a couple of different companies.
So what was the influence that she had on you back then as a kid growing up?
I think it was, again, it was just this core faith and confidence in my abilities and the options that were available to me. Neither of my parents went to college, but there was always this built-in assumption that I would. It was never discussed. It was just the natural course.
And that was never
things.
Spoken?
Never spoken. Just naturally assumed, of course, I would go to college.
Did you assume that as well?
Yeah. I don't remember a time where I didn't assume that would be the case. It was just the natural progression. The next thing, you know, junior high school, and then
so
apply to colleges.
So no other option was put on the table, you know, when you were considering, so what are you going to do after high school?
No. It was always assumed that I would go to college. That was just there.
Huh. And what was Dad doing?
My dad is he's just retired, a mortgage banker.
And you grew up where?
Portland, Maine.
Portland, Maine. Wow. So you went off to college.
I did.
And when you think back, though, back then, were you actually working at all as a kid?
Oh, absolutely. What was
the first paying job you can remember?
Mowing lawns, the usual stuff. Mm-hmm. That was things around the neighborhood. I grew up in a fairly suburban neighborhood in Portland, and the kids mowed lawns for other neighbors and things like that. I think the first W-2 paying job, if you will, that I had was as a bagger boy and eventually a checkout clerk at a grocery store in the area.
And must have made a lot of money back then.
I'm sure it was $3-something an hour. I don't remember exactly. I think I still have that W-2 from that 19... must be 83 or something at that mm-hmm. point. But
did you need the money? What'd you use the money for?
I think I saved it or had pocket money for this, that, or the other thing. Mostly savings. Nothing I explicitly needed. My parents took care of the, you know, everything I actually would need for life as a young child.
For both you and your sister?
Absolutely.
You also told us a story about your grandfather, the window shade company.
Yes.
Can you explain exactly what your grandfather was doing and how that affected you?
Sure. He had a small business himself, and my grandmother worked with him. She was the receptionist and bookkeeper and did all the other things he didn't do. But he made and installed Venetian blinds and window shades in Portland, Maine.
Mm-hmm. So he was the entrepreneur of the family.
He was certainly the entrepreneur in my closed-in family. My father's father had worked for many years also as a carpenter for someone else, but actually I think must be in his late 50s or 60s, he went off on his own and sort of did carpentry work on his own. And so I saw that transition as well, that someone who started with a working for someone, mm-hmm. transitioning off and working for themselves.
So where is, as Mark was inquiring earlier, where does, what is it in your background as a child, perhaps? What is it that happened that said, here's the thing that's going to put me on a path to do the work I'm doing now? Other than the fact that college was an assumed next step,
I'd say as far as the specific work I'm doing now, it probably was college. Actually, I did undergraduate at Penn and did the Wharton undergraduate program and studied economics and public policy. And
why those things?
They interested me. That was I remember reading course catalogs and thinking this sounds interesting, and it's something that resonated with me. And I was lucky enough to find coursework that suited the way my brain works and suited my personality ultimately.
So how does your brain work? What are you really good at? Just naturally.
When we can't see.
I think I'm good in at an abstract level at dissecting a problem, figuring out what the path forward is, what pieces you need to put together to solve that problem. You know, obviously, growing up in a consulting firm, you start out doing small pieces of things, but I think I discovered that I actually had a reasonably good aptitude for seeing how all the pieces could fit together, not just the analytics, but the strategy and the approach and the personalities and the dynamics of everything.
And that's what Mark was asking earlier. So when did you realize you actually had that gift as a kid?
Oh, I don't know if I realized I had that gift as a kid.
Do you think someone did?
You know, maybe some of my teachers recognize certain things in me. You know, I'm a reticent Yankee. We don't necessarily talk about a lot of those things. But in hindsight, I'd have to say I'm sure some of those teachers and family members did.
Okay, Stephen. Thank you. Hey, Stephen, what's the website address?
It's www.narusllc.com, narusllc.com.
We've been speaking with Stephen Selleck, Managing Director of Narus Advisors, LLC. I'd like to thank my co-host, Mark Cohn of Opti4, for helping with the interviews. We've had a great lineup of guests on our show, including Marjorie Levine Scher, Executive Director, Medical Care for Children Partnership Foundation, Gretchen McCracken, Co-Founder and Partner, Golden Key Group, Manesh Gupta, President and CEO of Nixoft Systems Corp., and Stephen Selleck, Managing Director, Norris Advisors, LLC. This is your host, Les Smolin, and we'd like to thank our listening audience, and hopefully we've provided you with an entertaining and educational show. And thanks for listening, because otherwise we wouldn't have a radio show. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. You can also hear this program again at businesstalkradio.net. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
Volunteers are the backbone of many nonprofits, and Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington is no exception. Hi, I'm Renthia Ross, a volunteer and board member of the Fairfax County Boys and Girls Clubs. With the care and support of Boys and Girls Clubs in Savannah, where I grew up, I realized my dreams to go to college, law school, and become a lawyer. Now, I'm a corporate executive with GEICO Insurance Company for 20 years and counting. My success was made possible with the support of my family and caring adults from the Boys and Girls Clubs. I urge you to give to the Boys and Girls Clubs so kids can grow up great. Go to bgcgw.org to donate now.
Welcome back to The Dog Show. Up next, we have Satchmo. Satchmo is a member of the Shelter Pet Group.
That's right, a group known especially for their couch-snuggling, ball-chasing, face-licking, tail-wagging, backyard-hanging, and, of course, companionship.
And what breed would you say Satchmo is?
I'd have to go with maybe a lavish terrier-hound-chihuahua-looking kind of mix.
Tremendous dog.
I'd also like to point out Satchmo's coloring, a white, gray, brown, black brindle. Simply marvelous.
You know, it's such a treat to watch a dog like this.
Now, let's see him in action.
Look how he makes eye contact with his person.
That's actually known as the treat stare.
How intuitive. And now he appears to be excitedly turning in circles.
Ah, the happy dance, so common with this group.
And finally, the loving face lick.
It's great how he just gets in there and, well, licks.
Fantastic. But really, the best way to know an amazing shelter pet like Satchmo is to meet one.
Visit theshelterpetproject.org today. Adopt.
Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
Discover what it takes to become a pilot at the National Air and Space Museum Stephen F. Udvar-Hazy Center in Chantilly, Virginia. Join them for the 10th annual Become a Pilot Family Day and Aviation Display. See dozens of visiting aircraft on display for one day only. Enjoy hands-on activities, story times, and kite flying demonstrations. Saturday, June 14th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., sponsored by Booz Allen Hamilton. WTOP is a proud media sponsor. Visit airandspace.si.edu for details.
WTOP is proud to be a media sponsor for the 12th annual AFI Docs. The AFI Docs Documentary Festival runs June 18th through June 22nd with screenings throughout Penn Quarter in downtown Washington, D.C. and at the AFI Silver Theater in Silver Spring, Maryland. Ticket packages go on sale May 28th with individual tickets on sale June 2nd. More information is available at WTOP.com under events and at AFIDocs.com.
Before power in Washington is decided at the ballot box in November, it will be determined on the baseball diamond on June 25th. Republicans and Democrats will leave their political differences inside the Capitol and battle it out on the congressional baseball game for charity at Nationals Ballpark. Gates open 5:30, first pitch 7:05, tickets $10. It's a fiscally responsible way to help out several local charities. Join them June 25th for the congressional baseball game for charity. Get more information and buy tickets at congressionalbaseball.org.
Do you want to do more to help people in our community? United Way of the National Capital Area is gearing up for Do More 24, a one-day online fundraiser. On June 19th, you'll have 24 hours, starting at midnight, to give where you live and donate to the causes you care about. So on June 19th, go to domore24.org and donate to the nonprofits that serve the region. Get more info at domore24.org.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense responsive, federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and Federal News Radio.